A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This episode contains distressing themes and descriptions of violence. This podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener caution is advised. They Walk Among Us is part of the Acast Creator Network.
They got here at about 5 o'clock in the morning. Dawn was still about 2 hours away. It was cold. Leslie was still dressed just in her dressing gown.
She was blindfolded, her hands were tied behind her back, and sticky plaster was placed across her mouth.
He didn't want any sign of tension or distress on the tape recordings which she would make. He described how he tried to carry Leslie through the 5 or 6 inches of water in the bottom of the drainage channel, which was his hideout in Bathpool Park.
Welcome to Season 7, Episode 25 of They Walk Among Us, a podcast dedicated to UK true crime. Please listen to Season 7, Episodes 23 and 24 for Parts 1 and 2 of this three-part case. Late on the night of December 11th, 1975, Police Constables Stuart McKenzie and Tony White were on patrol in the Nottinghamshire area of Mansfield Woodhouse when they noticed a man walking in the shadows with his head down and a holdall bag over his shoulder. It appeared as though the individual was trying to avoid being seen, so the officers pulled over beside him. PC White, who was in the passenger seat, rolled down his window and beckoned the man over to speak with them. White told him at that time of night, they would just like to check where people were going, and he asked the man for his name and where he was coming from. The man replied that his name was John Moxon, and he was heading home from work. PC McKenzie took out his notepad and started to write down the man's answers, but when the replies stopped, he looked to his left and saw the barrel of a sawn-off shotgun being pointed through the open window of the patrol car. In what sounded like a Polish accent, the man said, "Any tricks and you're dead." PC White was ordered to climb into the back of the vehicle, and the armed man got into the front passenger seat. He held the shotgun to PC McKenzie's ribs and told him to drive. As McKenzie drove down the road at gunpoint, he made eye contact with his partner in the rearview mirror. The man asked if they had any rope in the car so he could tie them up, and White began to search the back seat. The patrol car approached a fork in the road, and the man told Mackenzie to drive towards Blidworth, a remote country woodland. Foreseeing that an isolated area would probably mean they would be killed, the officers both made a silent split-second decision. Mackenzie jammed on the brakes and swerved the car across the road as White shouted, "Get him!" and pushed the barrel of the shotgun away from Mackenzie's side. The firearm was pushed upward, and when White put his arm around the gunman's neck, the gun went off. The blast caused Mackenzie's eardrum to burst, and he stopped the car on the street before getting out as quickly as he could and falling onto the pavement. His calls for help were heard by people queuing in a nearby fish and chip shop, and two men came running out to see what the commotion was. PC Mackenzie shouted, "He shot my mate," as the back door of the car opened, and the attacker could be seen wrestling with PC White for control of the gun. Keith Wood ran over to the car and pulled on the man's jacket, dragging him from the vehicle, before doing what he described as a karate chop to the man's neck. Roy Morris, another patron of the chip shop, kneeled on the gunman as the officers struggled to handcuff him. The man was secured to a nearby railing after more people began to kick and punch him. The officers he had tried to just kill were tasked with protecting him from a mob of angry onlookers. Officer White had sustained a hand injury when the gun had gone off inside the car, but otherwise he was miraculously unharmed. The same could not be said for the man in custody.
Constable Mackenzie, you were driving the car last night. Can you tell me what happened?
No, sir. No comment. No. There'll be a press release by our senior officers later.
Constable White, I understand you tackled the man, which...
Sir, I can't answer that. We've been told not to yet.
So you can't tell me anything about what happened last evening?
The bosses will be giving an official statement later, sir.
Why, in fact, did you pitch in that night?
Due to the policeman. Entirely. From the fish shop door to the front of the car, when Mackenzie ran to the front and shouted for help, you know, in such a way, you wouldn't hesitate, you'd have gone yourself. That's what made you go. You know, you didn't stop and think, you just went, not really.
After being taken to Mansfield Police Station, the suspect was stripped and searched. A knife was found attached to his hip and another concealed in his boot. The man also had a shotgun belt that contained 22 caliber cartridges. Badly beaten, the man's eyes were almost swollen shut and his lips had ballooned towards his nostrils. He required a number of stitches and was draped in a blanket to protect his modesty as he was questioned throughout the night. Despite intense questioning, the man refused to disclose his name or speak about what he had been doing prowling the streets at night with a loaded shotgun. It was only when his fingerprints were found to match those on file for the Black Panther, the Mansfield police realized who they had in custody. Scotland Yard Commander John Morrison was contacted, and the CID in Nottinghamshire arranged for the suspect to be transported to them for questioning. After 2 days of silence, the man began to answer questions, only after lengthy pauses of up to 20 minutes at a time. Even then, he spoke in what can only be described as broken English. When the interviewing detectives told him that they believed he intended to kill the arresting officers, he replied, "I no mean to shoot policemen. The gun went off in struggle." The man was asked about the suspect wanted in connection with the serious offences committed while wearing a dark hood. And the man said, "Not me. I know Black Panther." Asked once more about his intent to kill the officer who had arrested him, the man said, "I would not have shot policemen. I know the Black Panther. You think I am Black Panther? If you say I am Black Panther, they lock me up and throw the key away." The suspect was told that the detectives needed to establish whether he had an accomplice, and he replied, "I always work alone. If I am Black Panther and they charge me with murder, it is better my family don't know. I will just disappear from sight behind bars forever." While still refusing to give his name, the man was asked if he could assist with inquiries into the death of Leslie Whittle. He began to cry and paused for a long time before saying, "No, sir. Not me. Not murder the young girl." Commander Morrison told the suspect they had evidence and needed to find out if he was working alone or if others knew about his activities. Incensed, the man replied, "Why do you have to mention an accomplice? Why bring others into it? I didn't murder her. I didn't even know who I was going to get from the house." The man was immediately cautioned and told that if he gave up his name, a plainclothes officer would speak with his wife and arrange a visit. The alternative was that she would find out what he was accused of once his photograph was published in the morning's papers. The man agreed, but asked that his real name be kept from the media. He then said, "I want to make a statement. I want everybody to know the truth. Will my lawyer be given it? The girl need not have died if the money was paid." The man arrested on suspicion of being the Black Panther was 39-year-old Donald Nielsen. Born Donald Nappy in August 1936, he was the eldest of two children, brought up in Bradford, West Yorkshire. His mother died of cancer before he was a teenager, leaving Nappy and his younger sister to be raised by their emotionally detached father, who frequently left them in the care of their grandmother. Years of bullying over his surname with taunts such as Nappy Rash meant that he was eager to leave school at the age of 15. Donald Nappy spent a few years working in construction before he was old enough to enlist in the army. But his dreams were almost dashed when he initially failed basic training. He quickly joined the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, and before his first deployment to Kenya, he married his girlfriend, 20-year-old Irene, in 1955. Over the next few years, Nappy was posted in a number of areas overseas like Cyprus and Yemen, and steadily rose to the rank of Lance Corporal. Military life suited the young man who had grown up without any structure or sense of belonging, but he left the service when his daughter Catherine was born. The young family bought a house in the Bradford area of Thornbury. Nappy tried several trades such as joinery and taxi driving, but each business failed before he could get it off the ground. When Catherine began school in the mid-1960s, Donald Nappy decided that his daughter should not be subjected to the same name-calling he had endured, so he changed the family name to Nielsen. For the next 10 years, the Nielsens kept to themselves, rarely socializing even with family members. The newly named Donald Nielsen had isolated his wife following years of subtle coercive control, ruling the household with an iron fist. Irene and Catherine were often dragged out to the nearby countryside during the weekends. Far from a normal family excursion, Nielsen would have his wife and daughter carry out war reenactments and photograph stage scenes such as a bombed vehicle or a slain soldier on the battlefield. War games continued at home, where Nielsen steadily amassed a collection of army equipment and weaponry. He also drove an Austin Champ Jeep, the type of vehicle used by the military. As his business ventures continued to fail, Nielsen fell into debt, and he began to carry out burglaries on homes and sub-post offices where he rarely encountered the occupants of the properties, and even if he did, he stole the money and fled. Each raid was meticulously planned with military precision. Nielsen would spend a significant amount of time preparing to break into a property by scouting out the area, noting any security systems, checking to see if there were any dogs, and even posing as a customer in the sub-post offices. He did not know how to break into safes, but he knew the keys would be on the premises. Nielsen would then pack a holdall bag with a pencil-like torch to allow him to search through safes and tills, a lighter to make a fire in case he was out all night, a razor to cut clothing to make a bandage in case he got hurt, and a change of clothes. He always left the scene on foot and used public transport to get home or hide in secluded areas nearby until the police activity died down. Before he entered a property, he would put a black hood over his head with just slits for his eyes, entirely concealing his face. In dark combat clothing, he would use a brace and bit method to prise open windows and clamber inside. Nielsen trained for what was referred to as his missions through heavy exercise, walking or running long distances over rough ground while carrying a backpack. Through his meticulous planning, he had avoided detection. That was until Nielsen was finally apprehended on a winter's night in December 1975. Once Donald Nielsen revealed his name, the police travelled to his home at 1129 Grangefield Avenue in Thornbury. After midnight, Irene and Catherine were awoken by knocking on the door. As teams of officers began searching through the property, Nielsen's family learned that the man who had controlled their lives for so long was the most wanted man in Britain. In a locked loft room, officers found a sawn-off shotgun equipped with a homemade silencer, thousands of rounds of different caliber ammunition, maps, keys, hoods, wire identical to that found around Leslie Whittle's neck, tape recordings of Leslie's voice, manhole cover keys, U-bolts, Dymo tape machines, combat clothing, and an ornament portraying an animal. A Black Panther. While questioned by CID detectives and Scotland Yard Commander John Morrison, Nielsen agreed to make separate statements about each murder he was accused of. He admitted to breaking into the sub-post offices in late 1974 and said he was determined to clear up misinformation the newspapers had printed. When asked about the murder of Sidney Grayland and the brutal attack on his wife Margaret, Nielsen became upset and said, "My God, this is a bad one. You might as well know it was me. I must tell the truth of what happened." Bizarrely, Nielsen made the startling claim that each shooting had been an accident. Then he spoke about the kidnapping of Leslie Whittle, something Nielsen had been planning since the details of her father's will were published in national newspapers in 1972, years before her abduction. He thought that because several hundred thousand pounds had been given to George Whittle's partner and children, getting £50,000 as a ransom would be easy. It would allow him to retire. Nielsen told detectives, "From the will and income from the existing business, I estimated that £50,000 would be sufficient for me to finish with crime, but would not be too great a loss as it left a considerable amount. I reckoned that the mother would immediately pay a ransom of this amount for the son, or alternatively the son for the mother." Nielsen claimed that he had plotted to kidnap Dorothy or Ronald Whittle. He initially planned to have the ransom thrown from a moving train near Bathpool Park, but changed his mind when he stumbled upon the shafts. Nielsen had discovered the underground drainage system while searching through Bathpool Park during the planning of the ransom trails, and he had spent time learning the fastest escape routes along the way. With what felt like a foolproof kidnapping plot in mind, Nielsen drove the stolen Morris 1300 to the Beechcroft home in Highley and parked nearby in the early hours of January 14, 1975. He had packed a sponge mattress, sleeping bags, torches, a tape recorder, spare batteries, a bottle of brandy, Dymo tape, writing pads, pins, plastic bags, paint, a survival blanket, a plastic sheet, a length of wire, fasteners, socks, flasks, food and spanners. Shortly before 3 a.m., he walked to the back door of the garage connected to the house. The door was open. He removed the handle of the door leading into the home and used a pair of pliers to turn the spindle. Dressed in his usual outfit of dark combat clothes and a hood, Nielsen cut the telephone line before walking up the stairs. The floorboards on the landing began to creak, so he went into the first bedroom he came to and walked toward the bed. Nielsen later told the detectives who were interviewing him, "There was someone in bed. I woke the person and said, 'Don't make any noise. I want money.' The person replied, 'It's in the bathroom.' I said, 'You show me.' A girl got out of the bed. She was naked. I said, 'Put some clothes on.' She took a light coat from the bed and led towards the bathroom. The boards creaked loudly. I heard a sound from a bedroom at the end of the passage. The door was open. I pushed the girl onto the top step of the creaking board and motioned her to go down the steps quickly, as I thought someone may be coming. We went out towards the back door." Only referring to her as the girl, Nielsen added that Leslie put on a pair of slippers as she was threatened by the shotgun he was carrying. In the garden, Leslie was shivering. Nielsen covered her mouth with a plaster and put her into the car, where he covered her with a mattress. From Highley, he drove the 63 miles to Bathpool Park, which took over an hour. Before sunrise, he parked the car and ordered Leslie to stay put while he took the sponge mattress and sleeping bag down the vertical shaft and through the tunnel, and placed it on the lowest platform of a 63-foot shaft. Nielsen said something that explained a comment Leslie made on part of a recorded ransom tape when she mentioned getting wet.
"No need to worry, Mum, I'm okay. I've got a bit wet, but I'm quite dry now. I've been treated very well. Okay?"
Nielsen said that as they went down into the drainage system, the dressing gown she had been wearing got wet, so he told her to take it off and dry herself with it before she got into the sleeping bag. During the first day, he He printed more Dymo messages and got Leslie to record a message that would be played over the phone on a call to the telephone box at the shopping centre in Kidderminster. A statement later made by Nielsen read, "When dark, I went out and took car to Walsall to commence putting out instructions for collection of ransom. All these were taped in telephone boxes. The last telephone box was outside the bus garage at Dudley. After completing laying instructions at Dudley Zoo, I went back to the telephone box at the bus garage with taped instructions on cassette the girl had made earlier that day with the ransom message to her mother. I dialed three telephone boxes alternatively at Swan Shopping Centre, Kidderminster, at approximately midnight. After a few times dialing all three, dialing tones at the other end went different, a kind of discontinued or engaged signal. Then I dialed for the last time and someone answering said, 'Who is this?' I then rang off. As this voice was not normal and all three boxes were close together, I suspected a trap and returned to Bathpool." Nielsen knew that he could not use the same ransom trail again after no one answered the phones that night, and he had to abandon the second trail when he was interrupted by Gerald Smith. He told Leslie Whittle they had to record another message because the tape recorder had broken. As Ronald Whittle was waiting at the shopping centre surrounded by journalists on the second night, Nielsen made his way to a phone box outside the post office in Dudley. Leonard Rudd, the transport manager for the Whittle coach firm, was the one to answer the call. Nielsen said, "I thought at the time it was a male member of the Whittle family, and a voice stated positively that there would be no tricks. From the sincere tone of his voice, I fully believed that the instructions would be carried out as I had been assured. I returned to the girl and told her they were bringing the money. It would take about 2 hours for them to get there, and then she would be going home. She wanted to come with me, but I explained she would be better waiting there just a little while longer until everything was finalised. I explained I had to go get ready to collect the money so no one would be seen, and they would not be able to set a trap." Nielsen estimated that Ronald Whittle would arrive at around 2 a.m., but he did not realise that Ronald had not only been held up at the police station while Scotland Yard investigators microfilmed each note, but it had also taken Ronald some time to find the instructions that would lead him to Bathpool Park, and he had got lost on his way there. As Ronald Whittle was rushing to the ransom drop, Nielsen was preparing to escape once the money had been delivered. He had removed the metal grill at the entrance to the drainage system to allow himself to be able to get into it as quickly as possible once Ronald arrived. He anticipated that the police could have put a tracking device in with the money, but he believed the depth of the drainage system would make it impossible for the police to locate it. Nielsen watched from the top of the hill with binoculars as the torch was left flashing at around the time he expected Ronald to arrive, but when two cars pulled in at around 1:30 a.m, he suspected it was the start of a police trap. Shortly afterwards, another car pulled in and drove past the spot he had mentioned in the ransom instructions. Nielsen said he decided there was no point in waiting any longer. He entered the drainage system through the grill opening and walked along the tunnel to a smaller pipe that led to the platform above the one Leslie was being kept on. Nielsen later told the police, "I saw the torchlight from the other side as the girl had on her torch. As I came down out of the short tunnel to the platform, the girl moved to her side to allow me onto the platform beside her. As I stood on the platform, She went over the side and was suspended from the wire I had placed there earlier to prevent her leaving the tunnel. I moved to the side of the platform that she had gone over. Her head was below the level of the platform. I saw her face. Her eyes seemed to be half closed and stopped moving. I froze, then panicked. The next thing I remember was shoving the cover to get out, and then I closed the cover. I stopped there for some moments, unable to think what to do. Car came up the road and into Bathpool. I started to dash from the top of the mound down towards the disused railway line. I fell and the bag I had in my hand spilled its contents. I lay still for some moments. Then along the track which runs under the bottom of the ski slope, I saw lights of a vehicle slowly moving towards this end of Bathpool. The car drove out of Bathpool towards Kidsgrove. I saw the car come back seconds later with no lights on. At this point I thought I was near to being surrounded. I started to collect the things and put them back into the bag. I heard sounds of dogs coming from as near as I could tell the dead end of the track. I panicked and fled in the opposite direction. For the fourth time, Nielsen claimed Leslie Whittle's death was an accident. He insisted that he never intended to harm her, and she had never seen his face or heard his real voice, so he had no fear that she would be able to identify him. Nielsen claimed he had intended to release her that night, even if the money was not paid, because he had no further plans. Quote, "There was positively no reason the girl could not return to her family and give her family and the entire British police force every cooperation in trying to find me. Even if the ransom was not paid, there was positively no reason to do the girl any harm. If for any reason the money was not collected that night, there was no further collection point planned, and the girl could not have been moved anywhere by me to give me time to look for a plan for a further collection point. If I did not wish to be caught, the girl could have been left where she was or left at the top of the drainage system whether or not the ransom had been paid. I could have made my escape to safety, leaving the girl to be found in a very short time by her family or the police."
Nielsen appeared in court handcuffed between two detectives and wearing an open-neck white shirt, an orange cardigan and fawn trousers tucked into Wellington boots. He was unshaven, his dark hair was uncombed, and he had what appeared to be two black eyes. The charge was that between the 13th of January and the 7th of March 1975, at Kidsgrove in the county of Staffordshire, he murdered Leslie Whittle. Asked if he had anything to say, Nielsen replied, "Not guilty, sir," and added, "Would it be possible for me to see a solicitor? I've not seen one yet." The court agreed after Detective Chief Superintendent Harold Wright had admitted that no attempt had been made to get him a solicitor. Nielsen then
made a special request. For 3 days, Leslie Whittle had been kept in a vertical drainage shaft over 50 feet below the ground, tethered by the neck to a ladder on a cold, damp steel platform. Leslie was forced to stay in a sleeping bag completely naked while her captor came and went as he pleased. For hours at a time, Leslie was left alone in the dark, with just a torch to illuminate the grim and grey prison she had found herself in. This was a teenager who the papers had labelled an heiress, but she had not even told her closest friends at college about the shares that were to be entrusted to her when she was old enough. The Whittles were not extraordinarily wealthy. The majority of their money was tied up in the coaching business, and they lived modestly, a far cry from the way in which they had been portrayed by the press.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Charged with the murder of Leslie Whittle 4 days ago, Donald Nielsen today faced 8 further charges. 3 of murder, 3 of attempted murder, 1 of kidnapping, and 1 of demanding money with menaces.
Put it on!
Donald Nielsen was held at Strangeways Prison during the pre-trial proceedings, and at one court appearance a man hid on a rooftop in a bid to attack him, but the police intervened. Britain's public enemy number one had become the most despised criminal and a media sensation. Much of Nielsen's life seemed to be an enigma. A family man who had a string of career failures, that managed to commit a series of horrifying crimes and evade capture from every force in the nation until a chance encounter with 2 police constables caused him to panic, which led to his capture. It was decided that Nielsen would face 2 trials at Oxford Crown Court. The proceedings had to be moved there because it was felt that the defendant would not get a fair trial closer to the location of his crimes.
Well, as counsel said in court, it was felt that there may well be a considerable amount of prejudice. There may well be many people who are potential jury members who had read an inordinately large amount of matter which had been published, particularly in this area on the case. But more important, as the Queen's Counsel representing my client mentioned, so many statements had been taken from people living in the Stafford area that it was bound to be the case that someone may well have known the members of the jury who had had statements taken and who may well have discussed the case with them.
There was unprecedented security in the Victorian courthouse when the first set of legal proceedings began under Mr. Justice Mars Jones on June 14, 1976. Nielsen had entered a not guilty plea to the murder of Leslie Whittle, but guilty to the charges of kidnapping and attempting to obtain £50,000 with menaces from her mother, Dorothy. Philip Cox QC opened the case by telling the jury that 250 witnesses would be called over the course of the trial. And whilst there was no question that Nielsen had been the man who kidnapped Leslie Whittle, the jury needed to determine whether or not he murdered her. The prosecutor told the jurors, "It is right that you should know all the details surrounding the relevant details in this matter, because you, in the end, have to make up your minds what happened in that tunnel where the accused took this girl. You will want to look at the way he had treated her, whether it was necessary to treat her in what I suggest was a hideously cruel way, whether it was necessary if all he needed was to keep her there until all the money was paid. These are the matters which you will have to consider. Whether it was necessary to keep her naked apart from a sleeping bag. Whether it was necessary to keep her substantially without food. The evidence here points strongly to make you sure that when the accused went back into the shaft, he went back to push Leslie Whittle from the third platform to her death. What other reason do you think required him to go to that third landing? You will have to think whether the probabilities are that she fell by accident after she had been there and had become thoroughly familiar with her surroundings." Philip Cox QC suggested that it was because of the, quote, "failure of his carefully laid plans," that Nielsen took Leslie Whittle's life by pushing her off the platform. Because of the noise of the traffic outside, the windows in the sweltering Victorian courthouse had to remain closed. The prosecutors and defence counsel were permitted to remove their wigs, and jury members were allowed to wear short sleeves and slackened ties. Dressed in a dark green suit, Donald Nielsen was accompanied by his counsel, Solicitor Barrington Black, and Barrister Gilbert Gray QC. Throughout the trial, he was kept at Oxford Castle Jail, connected to the courthouse by underground tunnels. The defendant cried when the tape of Leslie's voice was played to the court. The prosecutor suggested that Donald Nielsen push Leslie to her death after suspecting he was about to be trapped when Ronald Whittle was late to the ransom drop in Bath Pool Park. They questioned whether Nielsen had remained hooded for the entire time he was with Leslie, and argued that he had killed her because she could identify him. Ronald Whittle testified that his sister Leslie was not a timid girl, but she was fairly quiet. She was also not easily frightened, so it was not surprising that she had shown such resilience during the harrowing ordeal. When members of the police task force were questioned by the defence counsel, they had to explain the numerous mistakes made during the investigation. Scotland Yard had been called in to assist early on. Despite hearing Leslie's voice saying that she had got wet, and knowing that there had been a ransom drop arranged for Bath Pool Park, there had not been a thorough search conducted for almost 2 months. DCS Booth testified at length about his part in the inquiry. He said that Scotland Yard had told him they had searched Bath Pool Park the day after the aborted ransom drop, but he was so concerned that they had not found anything that he staged a televised interview midweek in order to have a plausible reason to search the park himself. Booth told the court that he had been pillared by other members of the police force over his part in the inquiry and would retire as soon as he could because of how he had been treated. Donald Nielsen took the stand in his own defence and gave his account of the kidnapping. After describing how he had snuck into the house and taken Leslie in his car to Bath Pool Park, he said that he carried her through the water in the underground tunnels, while she was blindfolded. Her hands were tied, and she was gagged with a large plaster. He said, I was using a soft voice instead of a harsh one. The whole purpose was that there would be no hostility between the two of us. I needed her to make the ransom tapes. It was essential that those tapes were in her normal voice, not showing any signs of tension or distress. Nielsen testified that after her dressing gown got wet on the way to the landing, he told Leslie to undress and get into the sleeping bag. Quote, I'm not in any way ashamed of the fact that I took the robe from her. I took it off her and the sleeve pulled inside out as it came off. I then gave her the robe to dry herself. I did not look in the sense of what it meant to look at somebody. I saw what there was to see without making any intention to look. It was necessary to take the robe and see that she was warm and comfortable and psychologically ease her mind so that she was all right before I went up to move the car. All this was done in as short a period of time as possible. Throughout the time I was with her, there was a feeling of detachment in the same way that a doctor accepts a patient in the hospital. He has a professional detachment, and I have given careful thought to it, and I think it was in this way that she was taken to the third landing. When asked why he had not allowed her to change into other clothes, Nielsen said it would not have been possible because the wire was already clamped around her neck. He insisted that he had been kind to Leslie while she was held captive. He had brought her soup numerous times, as well as a bottle of brandy, magazines, and pop music he could play on the tape recorder. Nielsen said he was to release Leslie on the night of the third ransom drop, whether the money was paid or not, and he had brought spare clothing for her to change into. She had to come out that night, he said. It was finished. The defendant described suspecting a police trap when Ronald Whittle had not arrived, and he said he had rushed down the shaft with plans to release Leslie and escape. I glanced down the shaft on my way down. I saw she had started to move as she normally did to allow me to get onto the platform beside her. As I was in the act of taking my foot off the ladder and turning to the front, I looked around and she went over. I held my left hand towards her with the intention of helping her. Donald Nielsen maintained that he could not save Leslie, and when he looked over at her, she was not moving. He testified, "This stopped me dead in my tracks. She was dead. There was absolutely nothing I could do. Throughout my entire plan, she was, as it were, my ace, because when she was released, she was the person who would give any information to the police. The strongest possible weapon the police could have in trying to detect me would have been a body. At no time did I intend to give the police such a weapon. It would have been the same as committing suicide." Nielsen said he had panicked and left things behind in a rush to escape. He also spoke about how much training and thought he had put into executing the plan. Quote, I was one man against the lot of them. Therefore, I planned it not as a criminal operation, but as a military one. To look at it in this way, the best they could have put against me would have been troops from the SAS. They would have been equipped with rifles and night sights, and possibly a device called a starlight, which is a piece of equipment that can be used to see at night. If the crime was treated as the most serious crime that you could possibly wish to have, these are the limits that would have possibly have been gone to. I thought when I planned it to take it to the extremes, that it was possible for the enemy to plan to detect me. But I didn't expect to find a squad of SAS waiting for me at Bathpool. Nielsen insisted he had no reason to fear being recognized by Leslie, as he had worn a hood the entire time and disguised his voice. During cross-examination, Nielsen refused to admit that he had made a number of mistakes and left damning evidence in the tunnels that would ultimately link him to Leslie's death, when he said, "I am proud of the fact that the plan worked. I am talking about the entirety of the plan and not in any way the death. It was not part of the plan." The prosecution managed to catch Nielsen in what they believed was a lie, when after insisting Leslie never saw his face, he made a statement about how she saw concern in his expression, something that would have been impossible if he had been wearing a hood, as he alleged. Prosecutor Philip Cox QC asked Nielsen if that were true, because the defendant had a daughter the same age as Leslie when she was killed. Cox suggested Nielsen could not face the truth of what he had done. Nielsen denied doing anything to harm Leslie Whittle and shrieked, "I did not kill her. My conscience is clear. As far as the act of killing her, I did not." On the 12th day of the trial, Nielsen's defense counsel said that Leslie Whittle would have lived if the wire that was clamped around her neck did not get caught on something when she fell off the platform. Gilbert Gray QC said that Leslie's height from her neck was 4 feet, and the wire measured 5 feet, so if the wire had not been caught on a stanchion, she would have landed with her feet in the water below and survived. The defense barrister said, "This is not a homicidal, deliberately assessed hangman's noose. I say it was a tether. You know that if you have a pet, you put a collar on it. When a man puts a collar on a dog, he is not regarded as an incipient strangler. It is not a nice thought, but we are not dealing with nice thoughts, but realities." Gilbert Gray QC compared the case of the Black Panther to the film The Pink Panther on the night of the Bath Pool ransom trail, and said that although his client was not a nice man by any stretch of the imagination, he had shown acts of decency towards Leslie. Gray remarked, "In all the chronicles of crime and punishment, have you ever heard and read of a ligature padded and lagged and made comfortable? Have you ever heard of a scaffold with a foam mattress prepared on it for the comfort and repose of a person about to be hanged? Have you heard of blankets prepared for warmth, brandy for sustenance, and soup ready and hot?" The prosecution argued that Donald Nielsen was a liar who only cared about keeping Leslie Whittle alive because he wanted her to make the ransom recordings. Referring to Nielsen's statement that his freedom was more important to him than the money, the prosecutor said, "I suggest to you it was this cold, logical, military approach to the problem which was paramount, and that he was totally devoid of feelings for human beings, devoid of feelings for this girl. His own freedom and safety came above everything else. It was safer, more logical for him to kill this girl than to release her and run the risk of subsequent investigation." Philip Cox QC told the jury to remember the words on the ransom message: "If police or tricks, death." He said the jury should ask themselves, was this an idle threat? To a man of his ruthlessness, the logical outcome of a kidnap is the death of the victim, whether the ransom is paid or not, because it removes a possible source of identification. In his summation, the judge said that DCS Robert Booth did not need to apologize for his actions during the investigation. Still, the judge deplored the fact that Booth had used his opportunity on the witness stand to launch a bitter attack on fellow officers. After the jury was sent away to deliberate, they returned after just 90 minutes. They had reached a unanimous verdict. Donald Nielsen was guilty. The sentencing phase of the trial was delayed, as Nielsen still had to face the charges relating to the post office raids and other crimes. As planned, the second trial was also held in Oxford. Nielsen was accused of the murder of Donald Skepper in February 1974, the murder of Derek Astin in September 1974, the murder of Sidney Grayland and the attempted murder of Margaret Grayland in November 1974, the attempted murder of PC Stuart McKenzie in December 1975, two counts of burglary, and possession of a firearm with intent to endanger life. Nielsen pleaded not guilty to the murder and attempted murder charges, and claimed the gun had gone off accidentally in each instance, meaning he was saying that on four occasions, there was an accidental discharge of a firearm he was holding that resulted in three deaths. Margaret Grayland had made an amazing recovery and testified bravely at Nielsen's second trial. She said the last thing she remembered was seeing Nielsen standing in the doorway. Then she woke up in the hospital days later. Margaret told the court that she and her husband Sidney had previously discussed what they would do if someone tried to rob them. "We always said that if anyone broke in, our lives were more precious than the money. I would have been prepared to give it over, but we were not even given that chance." Nielsen explained that he had expected the light to be on when he entered the Grayland sub-post office, and that Sidney would see him and listen to his demands for money. But the light was not working in the storeroom, and he did not anticipate Sidney to have a torch. Nielsen said that in the struggle, Sidney squeezed a bottle of ammonia Nielsen had in his hand. Prosecution would argue Nielsen had brought the liquid to disable his victims. The defendant explained, "I was blinded by the ammonia. I fired the .22 gun and lashed out with my foot. At the same time, my ammonia-soaked hood I pulled from my head." Nielsen said that he was attacked by a second person, but he did not know it was a woman. However, no explanation was given for why he had tied Margaret Grayland up or covered her with boxes. He did not admit that she had seen his face, and did not clarify how, even though he could not see, he still retrieved the money from the safe. Nielsen's account of Derek Astin's murder detailed how he had drilled a hole into a downstairs window frame and slipped the catch to gain access. As he walked up the stairs to find the safe key, the floorboards creaked, and he entered the first bedroom where he realized the children were sleeping. He believed the sound of the floorboards must have woken Derek Astin, who shouted something before pushing him into a bathroom and trying to get to the shotgun. Nielsen claimed that the gun went off by accident, and it was at that point he fled. Despite his insistence that it was nothing more than bad luck that the firearm went off, the defendant sobbed in the prisoner's box when Derek Astin's young daughter testified about the night of her father's murder. Nielsen claimed that he only carried a shotgun because it was a tool of the job and people took him seriously with it. He also said that he chose to steal from post offices because he believed it was government money, and it was no loss to anybody. When asked about the night of his arrest and his actions once the patrol car pulled up beside him, the defendant replied, "The only thing I could do was to keep the initiative. The two officers were together in the car and I was beside the vehicle. And with me having the shotgun, this means I had complete control. I got the shotgun out and held it so they could see it. Then I told the officer nearest to me to climb into the back of the car. I was in shock. I was in the hands of the police. I had equipment with me that the Black Panther carried. In a short space of time, I had lost everything. I had lost family, and I was being accused of being a character I am not." Nielsen admitted that he knew he was the person the media referred to as the Black Panther, but said, "The activities of the Black Panther covered a far greater range of far more serious crimes than the post offices. I am not the Black Panther, taking into account everything he is said to have done." The prosecution argued that Donald Nielsen was a man who was always prepared to kill in order to avoid recognition or arrest, and that he had intentionally shot the victims so they could not identify him or prevent his escape. During closing, Nielsen's defense counsel argued, "He is not the Black Panther. He is a jobbing joiner from Bradford. He walks on two legs, not four." Regardless of the defense counsel's claims and Nielsen's assertions that the killings were all accidents, the jury again did not believe him, and he was found guilty on all charges. On July 21, 1976, Donald Nielsen was brought back to Oxford Crown Court to be sentenced. Mr. Justice Mars Jones addressed Nielsen before informing him how long he would be spending behind bars. The judge said, "You are never without a loaded shotgun or other loaded weapons when you went out relentlessly on expeditions, and you never hesitated to shoot to kill when you thought you were in danger of arrest or detection. You showed no mercy whatsoever. You decided to embark on the ultimate villainy in kidnapping a young girl of only 17 and blackmailing her mother, an enterprise which ended in murder. The enormity of your crimes put you in a class apart from almost all convicted murderers. In your case, life must mean life. If you are ever released from prison, it must only be on account of great age or infirmity." Donald Nielsen was handed four life sentences, as well as a total concurrent sentence of 61 years for the charges relating to the kidnapping, the ransom demand, burglary and possession of a firearm. Donald Nielsen began his sentence in Wakefield Prison, but for some it felt as though he had managed to escape justice. 3 months before Nielsen was brought to trial, Gerald Smith, the security guard who had been shot multiple times after confronting Nielsen in Dudley, died from complications following a colostomy surgery. Gerald Smith had been seriously wounded in the shooting, but he did not die until 14 months after he had been shot, which was past the legal deadline for a murder charge to be brought. Gerald had spent over a year with life-changing injuries as a result of the shooting. He was doing well, and his wife and two young children believed he would make a full recovery. Vera Smith later said, "We had made plans to have a holiday in August to celebrate the fact that Gerald was on the mend. I thought God had given him back to me after our great trial, but now I feel numb." The charge of attempted murder was left on Nielsen's file, but he was not tried for it. Vera said, "I am very, very upset about this, but it is a fait accompli. There is not much that I can do about it, but justice has not been done as far as my husband is concerned. He was the main person in my life, and not someone whose death should just be tucked away as if it did not matter." So where are we now? Detective Robert Booth was removed from his position as head of West Mercia CID and returned to uniform following his damning testimony against the other officers involved in the case at Nielsen's trial. After 25 years as a detective and being awarded an MBE for solving all 70 cases he had investigated prior to Leslie Whittle's kidnap, Booth's career and reputation were irreparably damaged by the mistakes made during the first few days of the investigation. He faced disciplinary proceedings, but after speaking out following his retirement in 1980, he was exonerated in the eyes of the public. Booth spoke about the case a number of times and said while he felt responsible and he had failed Leslie, Booth had no regrets about his testimony and that he had said everything he wanted to say on the stand. Donald Nielsen's wife and daughter managed to stay out of the spotlight following his arrest and conviction. They had no idea that the man who had made their home life so unbearable was in fact the Black Panther. In 2008, Donald Nielsen applied to the High Court to have his sentence set at a minimum term so he might see parole in his lifetime. Mr. Justice Tare, who presided over the Queen's Bench Division hearing, denied the application and said during his ruling, "This is a case where the gravity of the applicant's offences justifies a whole life order." The following year, Nielsen was diagnosed with motor neurone disease and was transferred from Full Sutton to Norwich Prison to meet his medical needs. On December 18, 2011, Donald Nielsen died in Norfolk and Norwich Hospital after contracting a chest infection and pneumonia. He was 75 years old and had spent 35 years behind bars. The coroner overseeing Nielsen's inquest said, "At the time of his death, he struggled to do even the most basic things and was virtually dependent on other people. Defiant even when facing death, Nielsen was described as being a challenging and uncooperative patient who had asked to be allowed to die." The police protocol in the case of a kidnapping has thankfully changed since Leslie Whittle's abduction. The media are now strictly forbidden from publishing details of ransom operations, so the chances of finding a victim alive are the best they can be. Thank you for listening. And special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For more information on this episode, please see the show notes or visit our website, theywalkamonguspodcast.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.